I'm going to talk about some of the experiments that we've done on granular flow, mostly on dense sheared flow, but I will mention a few other things at the end that we've also done, but I won't talk about them in detail. We focus on shear because we think that that's a central property that would have to be understood. The novel feature of the experiments is that that we can image inside the fluid, inside the material in three dimensions, and this does in fact give us some insights that we wouldn't otherwise obtain. These particular experiments, well, we have done some work at a high shear rates, but what I'm going to actually talk about is quasi-static granular flow, very slow granular flow, where the kinetic energy is actually smaller than the elastic energy, and is basically negligible. And one of the particular features I'm emphasizing is the importance of structural changes having to do with the arrangements of particles and their effects on flow, something that has also been seen in other types of systems, particularly colloidal systems, going back some years, although we've explored it in a different way here. But this kind of phenomenon has also been seen over a range of scales. There are lots of experiments on sheared granular flows, dense granular flows. Of course, if you started counting avalanches and chute flows, you probably have hundreds of papers. But here I'm emphasizing controlled flows of constant speed, not gravity-induced flows. So let me go right into the geometry that we're using in these experiments, which is basically an annulus of material that is sheared from above. That is, there's a rotating ring that drives the material. So we think of it as plane cuet flow bent in an annulus. It's not the circular cuet flow. It's more like plane cuet flow, but bent in an annulus. So that's the geometry. And then we put the granular bead pack in there with the fluid that is matched in index of refraction. And then we illuminate with a laser sheet, which of course sees a transparent medium. You don't actually scatter on this medium because of the index matching. But to make the particles visible, we put a fluorescent dye in the fluid, so the particles are outlined as a result of the dye in the fluid. And when we image this will all become quite obvious in a moment. So this is just a side view of the apparatus, showing the circular channel in cross section. And the fact that it is under pressure from above, this is the ring that provides the pressure on the granular material, but the pressure only is applied to the particles. The fluid itself can seep out and equilibrate in this chamber here. So in other words, the volume of the material can adapt depending on flow conditions. It's not fixed.
You're the point there.
Am I standing in the way of the screen in this distraction?
Well,
I didn't bring one.
You can point.
Yeah. Okay, so there's pressure applied, which is important to recognize. We can take a cross section horizontally vertically, depending on how we orient the laser sheet. We can look at near the sides of the channel. We can look near the top, near the bottom. We can look in three dimensions at, and actually you see different things depending on where you look. So that's the idea of the geometry.
To what extent are the particles density matched?
They're not density matched. They're heavier than the fluid. But the weight put on it is so much that the gravity, we consider gravity to be unimportant, because the normal force is 10 times the weight of all the particles. So we think of this as not being affected significantly by gravity. We believe that's the case. And gravity can be neglected. Now, you might wonder whether about the connection between a fluid-filled granular material like this and a dry granular material. And this is certainly an important issue. Certainly, if you have a dry granular material with a little fluid, it's dramatically different than a dry fluid. It's cohesive. O'Shaughnessy has done some beautiful experiments on that, for example. But if you have it completely immersed, and the flow is sufficiently slow, then we believe that the fluid actually does not have much effect, except to reduce the effective friction coefficient between particles. So it lubricates.
But is that a known fact?
It's something you can estimate to be the case, because we can estimate that the normal forces are much bigger than any viscous forces that are present.
Is it to do with the sort of diffusion time scale?
Sorry?
It's sort of to do with the diffusion time scale for the core pressure to decay, which is a few particles in certain movements, which should be, you can estimate it easily enough.
Well, the...
It'd be very low.
The time to diffuse... okay, so that's not what I was talking about, but you could also make that estimate. Probably we should also make that estimate. That would be another criterion. That is, you could say it's maybe not sufficient to say that the normal forces exceed the viscous forces. But you might also worry about transients when changes take place. This is what we...
Well, yeah, but I'm sure it's very low.
Yeah. I think it's...
But there's a test of this, and that's doing the experiment without the fluid.
We have.
You can't image, but you can at least compare the very logical response.
Yes, we have, actually. And what we see is that some of the rearrangements that we're talking about take longer, but that the qualitative effects are similar. So it's not exactly a quantitative demonstration, but there's some information on it.
But, sorry, Professor, but the viscosity is dense on the source.
Yes.
Fluid. So if you estimate... I think I agree with you, basically, that the answer don't change. But if you estimate how much time it takes for the fluid to get squeezed out as the particles come together with the pressures that you're talking about, it does take half a second or so for the fluid to get squeezed out of the contact if you estimate that time.
It takes an infinite length of time.
But to get down to about 2 or 3 atoms or
Yeah.
The roughness of the solid
state. Yes. I think what you're saying is that there may be films of fluid surrounding the particles that we're not actually seeing the hard particle contacts.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. Yeah.
I think that's true. It sort of depends on how fast you're pushing it, but a typical flow rate might be we might be driving at 10 particles. Particle diameters per second, and the velocity gradient from one to the next might be 1 particle diameter per second. So maybe we have a second for one particle to move over each other, the next its neighbor. And so in that time, they might not touch in the microscopic sense. Whether that makes any difference, I mean, I think the effect of that macroscopically, if you want to model this, is that you have a much lower friction coefficient between the particles, and I think that macroscopically that would be the dominant effect. But it's important.
What is the unit of the viscosity there?
Right? Small cell scale, small C scale, that's what it's.
Then it soaks. 10 times water. I guess that's not a great unit to use. So I'm going to talk about four issues. The crystallization transition, the role of boundary conditions and history, and one of the interesting observations is that there are multiple states that are reached for different initial conditions under some circumstances. The third item is the it's trying to understand the velocity profile, and the fourth is some experiments on motion of individual particles. So those are the types of things I'm going to describe. So this is what the what the flow looks like. This is a vertical cross section. So we have a vertical laser light sheet, and remember that the that what you're seeing is the fluorescent dye in the interstices between the fluids. Some of the particles look larger than others. For example, this one looks small, but of course that has to do with where the sheet cuts the particles. And so some of the size variation here is not real size variation of the particles, but rather it has to do with the location of the beam that is being used to visualize. So that's...
Jerry, can I just make clear, because you use the word correct in your description,
yeah,
correct, it's absolutely clear. So you... The velocity gradient direction is the vertical.
That's right. Now, plane correct flow is flow between, ideally between two infinite planes, right? That are across which there's a shear. But this more precisely, this is analogous to a finite version of that, where the plane is restricted in its.
Yeah, I'm just confused because the correct viscometer is the rotating cylinder.
So people use the term circular couette, where it's driven from the rotating inner cylinder. There's no rotating cylinder here. The sidewalls of this channel are fixed. They're both of them fixed. So we do have two cylinders, but they're not rotating. The only thing that's rotating is the top boundary. But the channel is about 30 particles wide, approximately.
This is a developed flow you were showing us, or the start-up?
It's
reached a steady state, hasn't it?
The answer to that is that there's not very much difference between the two. It starts, it does not take long to develop. In fact, the...
But it will go on like that in a steady
indefinitely,
state.
Right, indefinitely.
The density of particles looks higher at the top than at the bottom.
Hard to answer that. It might be slightly. It has been sheared for a while. It might have become somewhat more compact, yeah, at the top. But the compaction transition when it occurs goes throughout the bulk. But there might already be some compaction at the top.
That's, I think it's a little bit of an optical illusion because it's brighter at the bottom. The light is probably coming from the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, but there may be some more. There's a big hole here. I think that's what Jim was talking about.
Yeah, I think it seems a big hole.
Yeah, so it's possible that that's the case. I mean, we try to make it homogeneous when we put it in, but at the instant that you're seeing here, I don't know how long it's been sheared. Okay. So I want to show you what happens over a period of time. Unfortunately, I think it's projected. It takes a while. Okay, disordered flow as you watch it. Watch carefully. It's many hours that it's being sheared like this. There you go. See, suddenly it becomes ordered here. Did you see that?
Yeah.
And It's still rearranging some down below, but pretty much the whole packing becomes ordered. Now, that was pretty striking when we first saw it, and it changes the flow field quite substantially as well.
In this case, is there top and bottom are both rough?
Yes, but that's right. And what happens does depend on boundary conditions. So we do have a roughened top surface and a roughened bottom surface, but it's just a monolayer of particles on the bottom. And if you make it even rougher at the bottom, you can suppress the transition, which surprised me actually, because I would have thought that what happens down here would be completely negligible, unimportant, because the flow is very slow down here. In fact, I advised Jason Tsai not to waste his time on exploring what happens down there, but it turns out it does matter.
Do you have an idea of what is happening inside one layer? I mean, what is the structure?
It's basically, yes, I'll show you. Well, here it is. So when it's ordered, you have a flow like this. It's coming up, hopefully. Apparently you can only show one video at a time. I don't know why that is. So that's what it looks like within one layer. A coherent, hexagonally closed packed layer.
It's like graphite.
It's like graphite.
So that's from above?
That's yes. Seen from above, yeah. That's a horizontal slice.
Yeah.
And then if we, let me show you now what it was before. Before it was, order, same thing. So before the order of transition, you have basically independent, quasi-independent motion of the different particles. But once the transition takes place, they're coherent in their motion.
And there is a weak shear at this point.
There is, because it's the radius of the, there are two different radii, the inner radius and the outer radius, not quite the same, so the angular velocity is the same at both, so the linear velocity is different here and there.
Harry, it looked very much as if the right wall was pinned. I'm sure it's
well, in this one, yeah, actually, in the disordered case, you get something like channel flow, where the velocity goes close to zero at the sidewall. So you see something. I've got a picture of it somewhere, but there's a little slip, but you see something like that in the case where you have the disorder. But in the ordered case, it doesn't do that. It's almost flat. It's almost like plug flow all the way across, because the particles are engaged with each other and they move around coherently.
Presumably the ordering is because we're using spherical particles.
Well, we
don't stand there.
Yeah.
It will be disordered, I guess.
Well, it might with sand, but on the other hand, we tried it with a binary mixture and two particle types that were quite different from each other. And what happens is that it segregates, and then the separate layers crystallize. Yeah. Now, if you have a continuous size distribution, then it might not order. But I think the one of the lessons for us in this is that probably in many granular flows there is some microscopic evolution going on. And that that this is affecting the macroscopic flow. And whether it may not be generally as pronounced as what we see in this idealized circumstance, but it's certainly an issue to be aware of.
Chair, yeah. Do you mean there is a sleep velocity on the side walls?
Yes, I can. Yes, I'll come to that later. I have a picture of it. But in the ordered case, there is a slip velocity on the side walls, which are smooth after all. So
and no sleep velocity on the.
But not on the top, or very little on the top. Okay, so we tried to explore this transition as much as we could, and we measured a number of different aspects of it, which are summarized here. One of them is the development of the spatial ordering time. This is all in time over some hour. This is 40,000 seconds in this particular run. So we use a Fourier transform technique to estimate the degree of order in the tracking. And here's where we begin to see a well-defined increase in that order. We're looking at the intensity of a certain Fourier transform of the image. And when that order develops, we do see compaction of the wave. So there is some definite compaction, but it's still more dilute than a pure crystal would be, a hexagonally close packed crystal would be. It's significantly more dilute than that. I shouldn't have the number on it. It's in one of our papers, but because it is flowing, it can't be as dense as a crystal.
Let me understand the difference between this and Mutes experiments with the X-rays. There they saw these
layered
motion also. But they didn't see such a crystalline
pattern.
Is that right?
I think that's right. They saw a few layers of ordering, but they didn't see a well-defined transition. But these are in the experiments of 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah.
Right.
That's my understanding.
So does the transition seem to occur after a constant amount of strain? So if you halve the rotation speed, does it take twice as long?
Yes. Yes, it's proportional to the strain and not the time, really. That's right.
What can you give us the conversion? What's the shear weight?
Okay. The basic rule of thumb, here's the rule of thumb, that the transition occurs after the slowest particles in the system are translated by a few particle diameters. The slowest particles are located as far as possible from the shearing source. That's the rule of thumb. Now, one thing that I really should emphasize is that although the velocity, if you look in that first picture, at the first image I show showing the shear layer, it looks like the flow is confined near the top. It really is present everywhere. It's just slower, progressively slower as you go down. And even the ones at the bottom are moving.
Is that consistent with the surprising element that what you did at the bottom?
Yeah.
Affected?
Right. That's right. So if you really recognize that it is moving at the bottom, then of course it's not irrational to think that it might affect.
But it did. The order. The video you showed us, it did appear to layer at the top first.
It's not immediately evident. If you actually look at this, you're welcome to look at it again and again. It's not that evident. It's somewhere in the middle. But I don't know if that's representative of all runs. You know, I mean, you really have to take a statistical sample, and I don't have an ensemble of movies. So I'm not really confident that it happens at the top. I think it actually. I think that's one of the mysteries, one of the open questions is how does this develop? What kind of precursor state occurs that enables it to order? If you look here at the volume, you see that there's a little bit of compaction occurring even before this step change occurs. what's happening in this during this time interval, and is it homogeneous or is it, you know, is it near the top as Tom saw, thought he saw in the picture? I don't really know.
Is it consolidated to start with?
It's dense, but
so I would expect a dilation initially.
There is a little one.
Yeah, a little one, but it's very little.
Yes, it's a little hard to know. I mean, at the very beginning, you know, you put in the material, you stir it up, you put the top down, and of course, we don't know what kind of initial state you have, so I'm not sure that whether this is reproducible. So, we measured a couple of other things, which I want to point out. The shear force, for example, which goes down when the ordering takes place.
Did you observe this ordering transition for any value of the initial compaction?
No matter how we always got the compaction, no matter how we put the material in the cell.
Yeah. What was the range you explored, initial compaction? What was the range exactly?
Well, we don't really control it. You know, we're taking these particles and we put them in the cell. We don't have a controlled.
So you mean you make only relative measurements?
I'm sorry, these measurements, yes. These are relative measurements. That's right. They're not.
Because I think. Well, I understand. If you
have
a layered system, there is certainly a maximum compaction, which is compatible with layering.
Right.
I don't know if it is 0.6 or 0.62.
Well, it depends on. Yeah, I mean, it's not. It's not at this. At this value, it's not at the. Hexagonal close back.
Right.
Oh,
sure.
It's not
sure.
As high as that.
No, I was speaking of layered. Christian order,
right,
layered.
Right, right.
So it's much less than the fully hexagonal packing lattice.
Right. It's harder to measure the absolute volume than the volume changes. So.
Okay.
This is
does the velocity of speed of shear influence the
coordinate properties? It's. It doesn't really matter. It's the total strain that counts. And the velocity profiles, as you go down in the material, the velocity profiles just scale with the speed. So if you drive 10 times as fast, the velocities at each depth will be 10 times as large.
And that the exponential has found...
Well, I'm coming to that. That's okay, so one of the questions I think is interesting is what happens to the shear force? Why does it decline? One way to think of it is perhaps that there's less efficient transport of momentum, vertical transport of momentum with these smooth layers. They don't interpenetrate. So that may be the reason for the reduction of shear stress. I'll come back to the question of the particle velocity. But basically, the lower layers slow down when the transition takes place.
Why is it difficult to calculate the absolute volume?
Approximately. Well, you wanted to.
You can't go from the position of the level of the liquid and the position of your driving.
Yeah, you can get an approximation to within a few percent. Yeah, but not within a tenth of a percent.
Yeah.
Okay, this transition takes a time that depends on the thickness of the layer. If you have a very thick layer, it takes much longer for the ordering to take place. And that's what's shown in this picture where you have a logarithmic time scale for different layer thicknesses. This being a rather thick layer, and then this being for a much thinner layer. So it gets systematically longer, although it's not precisely predictable either. So we did it once once or twice with dry particles. Robin was asking about this, where we again saw the compaction is something we can measure even if we can't image. In this case, it seemed like it occurred in several stages, and it took longer than it ever did in the fluid fill phase, which is consistent with the idea that friction is restraining the particle rearrangements required for order. Let's see. Boundaries are really important in a confined granular material. For example, if we measure the height at the of the fluid layer after it's in rhythm for a while, as a function of the amount of mass we put in, we see a periodic function of the mass. In other words, it's not a straight line. The apparent height does not grow linearly with the amount of stuff you put in. And the reason is that the degree of ordering is periodic in the amount of mass you put in. So let me see if I can show you that with this this movie. There's a movie here where we systematically vary the amount of amount of mass. Let's see. There we go. That's 53 grams, 54. You notice it's rather disordered. 55, 56, 57, 58, 59. And then you see now it's become ordered pretty much. And if you keep going, it becomes, right now it's pretty much disordered again. So you see there's a kind of quantization effect associated with the size of the system. The degree of order.
Is this to do with the amount of mass you need to increase by one level?
Right, exactly. But the way the system deals with that is it may prefer, instead of ordering, it may prefer to spread the material over the full depth and remain disordered. So it's a little bit complicated what happens in a finite volume. Okay. Well, I'm thinking that I maybe should. I'm not sure if I should do this or not. The question of multiple final states. I think I have to say a little bit about it, but I'm not sure how far I should go. So, if we have this monolayer bottom and monolayer boundary condition on the top, we always get ordering. If we make the bottom more irregular by using a mixture of particles of different sizes, then it turns out that you tend not to get the ordered state. It doesn't crystallize spontaneously. But there are things you can do to make it crystallize. There are initial conditions that you can use that will make it crystallize. And basically, what happens is that to get the ordered state when it's suppressed, you use oscillatory shear, which favors ordering. And I have some ideas about why that is. But the main point I would make is that that there are conditions under which you could get either this state or this state as the final condition, depending on tap. So there's not necessarily a unique final state.
But if you shear the left one for long enough, you expect that at the very end, after a few centuries, you get to
a few after a few centuries?
Yeah, I'm joking, but the time to get to stationary and to order, or it is ready.
Well, we really don't think it happens. We really don't think it happens. And hard to prove it. It's hard. You can't. That's not an empirical question. You know what happens in infinite time. But depending on the kind of protocol we use, this is height versus time. We can end up in this low density state where the layer is thicker, or in this high density state, depending on initial conditions, depending on whether we oscillate the shear or not.
Can you shift it out of the high density state once it's there?
No. Once it's in the, once it achieves the high density state, it always stays. But in some sense, you might say it's the, it is this, it is the more stable state. But whether it, but the other one can be metastable. I mean, I think the, this bears on, questions of, how do you predict final states in a system that has many accessible configurations. It's sort of like the glass problem, I suppose. Anyway, it's a very clear manifestation of the lack of, the fact that there are many final states, many possible states. Okay, now I said I'd say something about the velocity profiles. Like somebody else. So this is the velocity profile, and shown here for this is log of the velocity versus depth in units of particle diameter going down 20 or 25 layer. And you can see that it varies over a factor of 10 to the 6. So it's, it is definitely moving when you get down toward the bottom, but it's moving much more slowly. And this shows the behavior for many different driving speeds. The question was, what happens if you drive it faster? And you see it's the same profile if you normalize it by the driving velocity. So this is part of what it means to be in the limit of slow flows. And presumably, there is a regime at higher flow rate where you would lose that scaling.
Well, you've got the shear band at the top, haven't you? Which is
you could call it a shear band.
Theory will predict,
huh? Yeah.
Which is what a continuum theory will predict. You get a shear band along the top, and that's.
You know how to predict. You know how to predict.
Sure.
The shear band. So. We expect a shear band would occur in an infinite layer as well.
Yeah. Somewhere.
How do you break the symmetry? But
gravity would be a big controlling thing. Yeah. I think you could make it go at the top more than anywhere else.
Okay. But in this experiment, we believe that we've suppressed the role of gravity by putting on
our it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah. Jerry, the sidewalls are a huge break.
That's right. I'll come to this. That's right.
This even looks like it made an asymptote at some depth.
Asymptote to?
Well, so that there'd be, below a certain depth, there'd be no movement at all. I mean, it's consistent.
If it's
following on down.
That's possible that it may. Yeah, possible.
That's a steeper than exponential decay.
Right. Steeper than exponential.
And basically, this is your graph which shows that the fluid is not inclined. Right? Because if you change the speed by order of magnitude and velocities.
Right. You're increasing the viscous forces without changing the particle contact forces. Yeah, I think that's at least some evidence.
Plotting linear scale, so.
What about
plotting? I mean, you're plotting log scale, everything was on top, but it's on linear scale.
Yeah, there would be
between 0 and 1, and that would be one proof or one.
Yeah. So you're saying it would be more sensitive to plot it on a linear scale if we wanted to check that?
Yeah.
Yes, we should. I don't know why the symbols here are so large. It's not really fair. But it's only.
Is the final state the older state or?
Yes.
And in case you have a non-older state, what happens?
We have some measurements of that. I guess this is it. So this is the comparison between the disordered state and the ordered state. Of course, remember the disordered state is transient, but you can make it last by using a bumpy lower boundary. And then you find quite a significant difference between the two. So the crystallized state definitely falls off much faster than the other one does. So so
that makes sense, because the crystallized state is forced to deliver sidewalks.
It's unable
to. It delivers its velocity all the way up the sidewalks.
Yeah.
And that will, even though they're smooth, that will have high drags.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So the profile really does depend on the. It's not what you can't solve this as a one-dimensional problem. Clearly, the fact that you've got a channel is important. That is actually demonstrated here in the next picture. Let's see. I'm going to show this. This shows the same profile. This limiting profile for a deep layer, but we tried shallower layers too, and it basically becomes a linear profile for a shallow layer, and that's what this graph is. The 9 and 0 is what you get in a shallow layer fitted to a linear profile. This is actually a linear profile, but shown on a larger scale. So the idea is if you have a thin layer, you see a linear profile. If you have a thick layer, it falls off as a Gaussian. So one of the questions is what's controlling the scale of that fall-off? And we wondered whether it was the particle size. And so we tried different particle sizes. And here are the profiles just plotted now here in dimensional units, with Z in millimeters, the different particle sizes, and they're all about the same in real units. But if you try to scale it and show the fall off as a function of depth in units of the particle diameter, in order to test the hypothesis that it's the particle diameter that's controlling the scale, then it doesn't superimpose. So in other words, it's not the particle diameter that controls this. At least it's not the only scale controlling the fall-off.
I guess you didn't change the width of the sample.
We didn't change the width.
Time.
No, that's right. But we didn't really scale everything.
Yeah. Okay.
Good point. But we have actually changed the width of the channel. And if you make the channel narrower, it falls off somewhat faster. So as you would have expected, I think. That the channel, the shape of the channel itself is influencing the fall-off.
Jerry,
yeah.
So there, it flows, even though you're sharing from the top here, it flows a little bit faster on the inside versus the outside. With the velocity slices you showed us.
Yeah.
Like this, you showed it at some middle portion, or if you look at it in different cross sections of the channel, is it different?
Well, the linear velocity, yeah, the linear velocity would be slightly different at different radii. Okay. So.
And there would be a large slip velocity at the.
In the ordered state, there's a large slip velocity at the outer.
But the peak velocity, because you would be in the middle somewhere. It would be monotonic between the walls.
It would be monotonic, yeah. Now somewhere in here I've got a picture of these slip questions at the sidewall. Here it is. So in the disordered state, remember I said that you see something like a channel flow? And the ordered state is almost flat. But it slightly varies from the inside to the outside because it's circular. So, Okay. Now, okay, so how do we understand the velocity profile in this finite geometry? So we have an idea here, which probably needs to be further developed, but here's a rough idea. Suppose you consider a cross-section of the material, and just assume that it's perpendicular to the channel, it's perpendicular to the stream. And Z is the vertical coordinate, and W is the width of the layer. Well, if you add up all the stresses on that being applied to that channel, they have to add up to zero if it's in steady state. So you have a stress being transmitted across the upper boundary at zero and the lower boundary at depth Z, and they're in opposite directions. So we have the difference between those two stresses times the width of the channel per unit length in the other direction. And that has to be balanced by the stresses applied by the walls, the tangential stresses applied by the walls, which we think of as being just a kind of friction. There's some number compared to that as if it's proportional to the length of the wall. So,
you don't know that it's in the walls independent
of depth. No, we don't. But I'm just trying to explain why you should get strong, this very strong confinement of the shear layer. Now, maybe it doesn't need to be, maybe shear layers are thought to be always occurring, you don't need to explain it, but which was the point of view you expressed. I'm sorry, can you remind me of your name? I forgot.
Tony Stan.
Okay. What department are you in? Are you affiliated with the department here?
Well, I've been here. I checked the
room
this week.
I said,
it's on the
river. Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, great.
Okay. You weren't here Tuesday.
That's right. I'm sorry. Okay, so anyway, so what that means is that that these stresses cannot be the same. The stress, there must be a depth dependent to the shear stress in the material. Well, what's the nature of that depth dependence? Now, usually people assume that it may be slightly dependent on strain rate. And in fact, there are some experiments that show a weak logarithmic increase with strain rate in the stress transmitted, the shear stress transmitted inside of a granular material. But it's generally thought to be a weak dependence. So I'm just proposing for a moment that it might be logarithmic, just to put in as an example, some kind of weak dependence. Well, if you do that, then it immediately follows that the strain rate has to be exponential in depth. Of course, we don't see an exponential, we see something that's more Gaussian, but I'm just trying to show that stress balance, including sidewall friction, along with a weakly shear rate dependent stress, are the ingredients you need to produce a narrow.
And Jerry, just to play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
In this geometry, I get an exponential shear rate profile with depth just from turning through.
Yeah, we looked at, that's a good question, and I can show you that. I think it was in this other picture that I sort of skipped over it. So you're asking, what would a Newtonian fluid do with the same geometry?
Well, I know what it would do, but
yes. So it falls off too, but it falls off much more gradually than the data does. Now it depends on the depth. It's the red curve that would be relevant to this data, because the layer is 20.5. Particles deep. So take this red curve, that's what a fluid would do in the same geometry that we're looking at. So there would be some fall off just due to the limiting size in the fluid. But the actual fall off is much steeper.
Yeah, the controlling factor here is friction, not viscosity. I mean, there's little bit of viscosity there, but
viscosity at friction at the sidewalls.
Or friction. No, friction between
the layers.
Between the layers, yeah.
So it's a little bit complicated, you know. You can't say that the sidewalls are completely negligible, but on the other hand, the confinement of the granular flow is much stronger than you would get from a fluid argument alone.
The normal force between two particles force towards each other causes 1/2 the distance, the lubrication approximation.
Okay.
But the shear stress, if you force two particles across each other, causes log of the distance. So that sort of supports the logarithmic argument in this case.
You mean, lubrication layers. You're saying a fluid argument alone would
yes.
suggest a slow variation with strain rate.
Yeah.
But that depends on the on how the average spacing between particles evolves with strain rate.
Yes.
So there's an unknown element. So you might be right, and it's hard to be sure with the information we've got.
Yeah.
Okay. So I need to come to a to the end. What would you? Huh?
2 weeks.
Well, I've got various things to talk about. One is that there are not sure what's most important. There are sidewall effects. So you can see ordering. You would expect this, that if you near the cylindrical walls, you might expect some local ordering, even in the case where the rest of the flow is disordered, right? Some layering, and we do see that. So when I talked about a disordered state, you know, when we started doing a three-dimensional scan, we found that it wasn't completely disordered. That there are that near the walls it does become ordered. So when you say that the flow is disordered or ordered, you have to be careful. That's the main point. And I've got a movie illustrating that, but I think I won't bother to.
That was when the bottle was very rough.
Yes, so that's right. Suppose you, suppose you suppress the order. This is, we're looking at different planes, different vertices. We're near the wall, and you see it's ordered. Whereas when we're in the middle, it's disordered. Okay, so it really is important to look at three-dimensional effects. Okay. I think that's maybe enough. Let me show you a couple of other things. One is that if you put different sizes in, eventually the large ones go up. And they said it will order in layers. You didn't see the beginning of this. They were all mixed uniformly. But the large ones go up, and but the ones that are trapped down low take a long time to move because they're in a region that's slowly moving.
I am a bit confused. Are they trimming naturally? Their density is lower, or?
Their density is not lower. But they just it's
the little ones fall into the
people generally find that the large ones large particles rise because the small ones fit in the interstices and go underneath them. But you actually do have the possibility of two different mechanisms here. One would be a gravitational mechanism. And the other would be a basically a shear induced mechanism alone, acting without gravity. We can't distinguish between them with the information we have. But
which ones are faster?
We have to stop.
The small ones or big ones? Which ones are faster than average? The big ones or small ones?
The big ones rise to the small ones. But they are both, but at a given height, they are both translating at the same speed.
This is the effect of why Brazil nuts always rise to the top.
Well, that's what people say. But you can make things go the other way too, depending on.
If you could drive from the fox on there, you could answer which effect's important. Which is whether it's shear and boost of gravitation.
Perhaps. Perhaps, but there might be other ways too.
Well, if they all came to the bottom, it was definitely going to cheer and just go from the bottom, that's where they went.
Yeah. Well, four without gravity.
It's not so easy to do the experiment shut down, but as you well know, as a quasi-experimenter, I'll just finish by mentioning a couple of other experiments we've been working on. One is that is a hydrodynamic clustering. It's not a shear flow, nothing to do with shear granular flow. But if you take a collection of particles on a surface that's weakly vibrating, particles come together. They form clusters. We think we know why that happens. It's what we call Rayleigh seeding. It's a hydrodynamic interaction between particles when they're moving with respect to a fluid. And recently we've done a study of the time-dependent chaotic effects that can happen in that situation, where we have particles that don't come to rest. They form this cluster, but they don't actually come to a static condition. Rather, they continue to have chaotic interactions, which are mediated by the fluid in which they're immersed. So that's an interesting hydrodynamic effect.
Is the length scale given by the oscillation frequency?
The length scale of the
average distance.
It would be more controlled by the excitation amplitude. It would expand somewhat as you increase the amplitude more than that. It's not controlled primarily by the frequency.
Jerry, can you just explain the geometry? You said it's a vibrating fluid.
Right. So we have a flat a fluid container that's maybe a centimeter high and 5 centimeters diameter. Fill it with fluid so there's no free surfaces. Oscillate this at 50 hertz with very small amplitude. Vertical. So the fluid moves with the container. The particles sit on the bottom, near the bottom, because they're denser than the fluid.
It's vertical shape. It's
vertical shape.
And the ratio of the vertical acceleration gravity is always less than one?
More than one.
More than one.
More than one. Somewhat more than one.
Okay. So they don't stay in contact with that.
So they don't. They move with respect to the bottom. They you might think of them as sort of slightly bouncing off the bottom. But of course they would be the equation
layers. So the effective interaction is logarithmic
in the separation?
Yeah.
That would be an oversimplification.
It would be a Coulomb gas.
All right. That would be nice. So that's one little experiment. This is another vibrating layer experiment where we have a collection of particles that are chiral. That is, they don't have reflection symmetry. What they are actually is something, they're little wires that are formed from three segments. So I'll try to sketch it out for you here. There's one segment like this, one segment like this, they form a right angle, and a third segment that is out of the plane of the first two, at a variable angle. So depending on that angle, we can make either left-handed or right-handed particles, we might call them. And if you take one of those, and put it on a surface, it will rotate at about once every few seconds, almost once a second, depends on the conditions. And if you take hundreds of them, they will form a collective rotation of the whole sample around the center of mass of the sample.
They're like sycamore seeds or something.
Sorry?
They're like sycamore
seeds. You mean being chiral?
Yeah, the fact that they're rotating, so they drop back down.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's an error.
Yeah.
But this is not a hydrodynamic effect. I don't know whether I never thought of using. There's no fluid here in this. This is just particles on the surface. No fluid. And
lock up collecting.
So they look something like this. If you look at them, you don't really see the collective rotation that much. It's not that big. But if you track the particles, you find that over time they rotate around the axis. So they actually take angular momentum from the driving source and use it to produce a collective rotation.
And it's random.
And the direction is random. The direction depends on the chirality of the particles. So. Okay, Arshad did an experiment where he looked at rod-like particles that can form a vortex that circulates in some direction, but the direction of the flow depends on initial conditions, presumably.
It's spontaneously
switches. It kind of switches during the motion. Okay. So in these, there's a definite direction of rotation which arises from the particle, the asymmetry of the particles themselves, the chirality of the particles. So that's the difference between what your experiment and what we.
How is it driven here? Is it vertically in and out of the plane?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, a slight, small amplitude.
So Jerry, if you prepare a racemic mixture, and you're very, very patient, what happens?
Well, we've followed the question, but we haven't got the answer.
No.
You might imagine that they will separate, phase separate. You can imagine several possible outcomes.
It's probably experimentally easier to prepare a system with a right-handed one side, left-handed on the other side, and see where they intermix.
Really, that's a better idea. That's a good idea.
It's a very long time.
That's a good idea. So this is, I don't know whether this is significant in terms of, you know, regular granular materials, you know, but you could certainly imagine that to some small degree, random particles like sand, you know, are slightly chiral.
Some of the isostatic elasticity, or the isostatic stress transmission calculations are really governed by the chirality of the arrangement of contacts around it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Awesome. That's really
interesting. So I think that's pretty much all I should say. I think I'll stop there and show you a few things that you've been interested in. So thanks.
You said you varied the width. Does this affect this strain to crystallization as well? If it was further apart.
So you're asking whether in the rotating shear flow experiment, does the crystallization still occur in the
as the walls get further?
Well, we didn't make them wider, we made them narrower.
Okay, but actually make them narrower, does the crystallization occur sooner?
You know, we didn't really do the careful velocity, careful, you know, time-dependent measurements of that sort. We were mainly looking to see how the velocity profile was affected. So I really can't answer whether the rate was.
In the crystalline case, when they do form these crystals, did you do particle projection, particle tracking over long times? The motivation for this question is, for example, Itai Cohen has done these experiments, you probably are aware of them, in koans, where in confined geometries, he gets these crystal facts which evolve differently than
depending on?
On the thickness of the particle. So if it is 5 layers deep versus 10 layers, so there's some interesting ways in which the particles flow past each other. So I was wondering if this was...
Well, we didn't do all that much. I mean, we made some efforts to track particles. We could show a big contrast between the ordered and disordered cases, where in the ordered case, particles stay within their layers, you know, and wiggle around, but they rarely move from one layer to the next. Whereas in the disordered case, they jump, they have much greater vertical excursions and they seem to jump from layer to layer. And so we've actually seen them diffuse or spread vertically, but that's about all we've done. So, so what did Itai say?
So he saw, so when he was, I think the connection maybe more in when you were talking about the velocity, the jumps in the velocity profile, or the compaction,
yeah.
I think, there it might be more relevant. I think he did this pull-out system which he was shearing, putting into place, and then as he increased the number of effective layers between the plates, so as he increased the thickness, he found the velocity profile essentially had an integer jump to, in the sense that nothing changed as he varied the width till he had gone over one particle diameter. Maybe I should sketch it later.
Yeah. And he thought we had, this is a colloidal system, he thought we had a linear velocity profile rather than a shear layer.
Right.
So that would be one difference between the two. And was Brownian motion important in that experiment?
Yeah.
What? So, any other questions? Okay, maybe we should adjourn.
Okay.